Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, via Skype, our guest will be editor Neil Clark of Clark's World and other things. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I've got to apologize again. I did see Split, M. Night Shyamalan's newest film about a man with dissociative identity disorder, multiple personalities, in other words, played by James McAvoy, who kidnaps three teenage women, prime among them Casey, a loner with her own demons, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, to use them as, quote-unquote, sacred food. I saw it during a regular screening with a good-sized audience, an audience, it turns out, that wasn't quite receiving it the way Shyamalan probably intended. Lots of laughter in there, so much so that I couldn't filter it out, which I'm usually good at, and develop my own feelings about the film. I point this out because afterward, I saw a clip from the film on TV, a clip which the audience treated as hilarious, and that thing creeped me out in the absence of their laughter. I will say this, I don't think the people I saw it with were completely unjustified in their response. There is good stuff in Split, particularly McAvoy's disturbing portrayal of multiple personalities, including an 8-year-old and a female zealot awaiting the advent of a mysterious superhuman beast, and there's a beautifully handled final confrontation between Casey and her captor. But the characterizations, particularly of the teens, are poorly motivated and a little too broad, a failing both of Shyamalan's writing and directing of the actors. In addition, Shyamalan introduces a fantastic element that doesn't quite sit well with the rest of the scenario, and then ties that into one of his earlier films in a twist, the legendary Shyamalan twist, that will have some people who know the director's work groaning, and others intrigued. And here's where the audience response tripped me up. I would have liked to have watched the film on my own terms so I could better take in what is revealed about the particular Shyamalan universe we're in that twist, which here is isolated to a coda that doesn't really impact the plot of the film, and determine if it brings a new context to the film as a whole, or if Shyamalan is just indulging in some ill-advised audience tweaking. I can't do that now, not with the vibe I experienced in that auditorium. I will probably watch Split again privately. I'm suspecting that it won't seriously change my opinion of the film. This won't land as one of Shyamalan's top efforts. By the way, you should check out last year's The Visit if you haven't yet. It's really good. But I am hoping to see additional value in it that was blocked for me this time. On the other hand, there was no effort needed to see the value in the 1947 French film Panique. Now playing at the Film Forum in New York, this tale of a triangle between a woman recently released from jail, the murderous boyfriend she took the rap for, and the fake psychic who falls for her is a fantastic example of French film noir, and a dark examination of suspicion and malice in a country only 2 years removed from World War II. If you want something lighter, Well Go USA recently released the live-action martial arts fantasy The Monkey King 2 on home video. I had some problems with the first film, which, like this one, is based on the Chinese classic Journey to the North, prime among them an overload of obviously fake CG effects. The same sin is committed here, but to his credit, director Soi Chang grants more empathy to the title character, here played with lashings of simian energy by Aaron Kwok, as he struggles against his instinctive self-interest and battles to gain the trust of his traveling companions, including a monk played by William Feng. It's fun, it's a bit too much, but I did enjoy it. And by the way, if you remember the Japanese animated film Alakazam the Great, which was also based on Journey to the North, Monkey King 2 is where you start to recognize some characters that were also referenced in that film. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
And for Hour of the Wolf, I'm Jim Freund. So, the way Skype works here is peculiar, but I am going to try to contact Neil now. If I did it off the air. Ooh, are you there? Hello, Neil. Are you hearing me? Are you receiving me? I can see your living room. Not that that matters. Oh, there you are. Hi. Say something. Ooh. Oh, okay. Hold on. Try that again.
Hello?
Yes. Ah, there we are. We've got a bit of lag, but you are indeed on the air, and not bad sound quality. I won't discuss, it's weird that I can see you, just like when we did our test run before, but now I'm actually using the WBAI studio. Is the sound okay on your end?
Perfect.
Okay, good.
I'm just getting an echo of myself.
Yeah, you know, Skype, I had hoped when Microsoft bought Skype and took it over, which is almost, I think, like 5 years at this point, that they would improve certain things. But I've been a little bit, as a technology reviewer, which I used to be, a little bit disappointed in that, I have to say. It's still got lag, time lag problems and echoes, and it's one of the reasons why I prefer... Well, of course, I prefer face-to-face interviews always, but in recognition of the modern world and in recognition also that I'm also producing things now for my own podcast eventually, Skype is going to be that much more important.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my guest this morning, everybody, is Neil Clark. That's with an E on the end. He is the editor of Clark's World magazine, which has won 3 Hugo Awards and a World Fantasy Award. We haven't said what this is. Galactic Empires is a new, very handsome book from Nightshade Books, a thick, nifty 600-plus page anthology, original anthology, all new stories.
No. They're reprints.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Well, who cares? It's a great collection.
Thank you.
Bottom line. Okay, but that makes it. No, well, a collection is usually one author. And your first one was upgraded.
Yes.
A few years ago. And then you began a Best Science Fiction of the Year series, which you're about to release number 2 in a few months.
Correct, yeah. We just released the entire table of contents a couple weeks ago.
Oh, okay. And I just remembered, as always, because I'm always thinking retrograde, I need to promote something. So bear with me a moment. February 7th, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings continues with actually being on the first Tuesday of the month. Last month was the second Tuesday, so we avoided the New Year's push. But we're back to that for almost 2 months. Jack Womack and James Morrow will be our readers. And that's a pretty darned good lineup, if I say so myself. Jack hasn't read for a New York Reading series in a bit of a while, I must say. And his latest book is classified as an art book. Let's not call it fiction or nonfiction. It's called Flying Saucers Are Real. But what it is an art book of all of the art and books and things of movies that projected the wiggling fingers reality of flying saucers. And doesn't bunk or debunk anything, but it's quite clear that the author has never seen one. And it's doubtful other people have. Jim Morrow has a new book coming out, and it's coming out in about 4 months. Do you remember the name of it, Neil?
No, it's eluding me at the moment.
Yeah, he just had a Galapagos book. He's absolutely wonderful and extremely religious. Christians will find him profane, which is delightful. What he is satirical. And he tweaks the noses of people that disdain Darwinism and, totally buy into the written word of the Bible. His book, Towing Jehovah, has God dying and falling into the ocean. And the commander of the Exxon Valdez, the ship that had flooded the ocean with oil, is given the job by the Vatican to haul the Corpus Dei, right, in Latin, I guess, to the Arctic to help preserve the body, and he's being directed by angels. There's a culmination of a scene in which a nun and a priest are making love in God's navel. And if you don't think that's heretical, then you're one of us, I guess. But, I mean, that's an example of Morrow satire. You know, it's not intended to be taken seriously, and in some ways it is. But it's both of these writers, Jim Morrow and Jack Womack, are very tongue-in-cheek and delightful and good readers. So that's a week from Tuesday, February 7th, in the same building as WBAI, by no small coincidence, 388 Atlantic Avenue. In Brooklyn between Hoyt and Bond Street. Admission is free, but we try to look at you beseechingly for your donations. And the cafe is wonderful. We don't go out for dinner anymore because the food is right here. So hope to see you February 7th. Okay, there, I did my pitch. Let's get back to talking about stuff. Clark's World is 10 years old this year?
Yeah, it's we turned 10 officially in October, and we're going to celebrate through the whole year.
Okay, very good. Very good. So, yeah, we have to conspire. We had a Clark's World reading when we were at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art with the Nearsif readings.
That was for our 50th issue.
Ah, okay. And how many years old was the magazine at that point?
A little bit over four.
Yeah, so that was 6 years ago then, approximately.
Yeah, we're on issue 124 now, so.
Oh, okay, yeah. We should do one every 50 issues, I think. That would be a good thing. Clark's World, for those who don't know, is an online magazine. It was a semi-prozine and is now a prozine. I work peripherally for Lightspeed magazine, which is a similar online publication. But Lightspeed was, Lightspeed was a semi-prozine. Clark's World was a semi-prozine, and both are now prozines. And what is so weird about that when it comes to award giving is that there's no Hugo magazine category for prozines. I've never understood that.
Well, there's not enough of us, is the common argument. And, you know, in before... you know, we crossed over and Lightspeed crossed over, and it was primarily just, you know, a small list, less than 10, probably less than 5 that most people could name.
I can name 5.
And so they've always tried to avoid creating categories with that few where the same people would be up every year, which is what got the semi-prozine category into trouble initially and almost got it canceled. With Locus winning it so many years in a row.
Yeah, but, you know, that's what happens. Certain people, writers, editors, I remember one year somebody won an award in a given category, and their acceptance speech was, "I would like to thank Michael Swanwick for not writing a short story this year."
Oh, yeah.
And it's a. We should explain the Hugo Award is a fan award. Anybody can vote for it,
but they have to be members.
Yes,
yeah. They have to pay up to join either a supporting or a full attending member.
Right, and not enough people vote because it's evolved into controversies in the last couple of years. And there was another one maybe about 15 years ago when a certain quasi-religious organization tried to buy so many memberships to the Hugo Awards to vote their people in, and it was discovered that the check numbers were all sequential.
That particular group of people seems to have a history of interesting stories around it when it comes to tinkering with numbers. Apparently, I heard a story once about them ordering many copies of a book to drive the sales up and then returning them.
yeah, exactly. Especially because a number of bestseller lists, like the New York Times bestseller list, are not based on how many copies sell, but rather how many copies a bookstore orders. And therefore, if you order a copy, well, that racks up the numbers. You don't actually have to buy it at that point. You just get the bookstore to stock it. Famously, Gene Shepard, along with That was interesting. You have a teletype there. It was Gene Shepherd in concert with Ian and Betty Ballantyne and Theodore Sturgeon. Created a bestseller out of a book that had never been written called I, Libertine. And after it got, basically, they got people to go into bookstores. You're announcing it on the radio and WOR over and over again. And the whole point was you went into the bookstore and you got the bookstore to order this non-existent book. And lo and behold, they got it on the New York Times bestseller list. Then they decided somebody had to write it, and Gene Shepherd didn't feel he was up to writing a science fiction book. So Ted Sturgeon did. And I have a copy with a cover by Frank Kelly Fries. It's a classic story of a book that was a bestseller before it was ever written. So that tells you about statistics. So I'm sorry, let's get back. How did you begin Clark's World? Being 10 years as an online zine that has succeeded is not something that many people did. Ellen Datlow had Event Horizon, which I worked on, and that lasted, what, about 2 years? 2 to 3 years?
Something like that.
Yeah. And I was one of the online chat interviewers for that. It was a lot of fun. And there really aren't that many. Omni Magazine, which is where...
at the tail end, yeah.
Yeah, at the tail end of Omni Magazine, before the current configuration, which really has nothing to do with the people who were Omni.
Yeah, I don't count them.
Yeah, I don't think too many people really do, including the old-time Omni readers. It's not a haven for them, in my opinion.
Well, there was Sci-Fiction as well, and that's sort of what got us started when Sci-Fiction closed.
Yeah,
You know, there was this big hole in the market, and
that was Batlow again. Yeah,
yeah.
And so, let me just say,
at ReaderCon one year, Sean Wallace and I were talking about online fiction and magazines, and came up with the crazy idea that we had a business model that might survive. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the weekend, we had the magazine staffed, and 3 months later, we had our first issue out.
Wow!
So yeah, a lot of overconfidence and seemed like a good idea at the time. Stuff went into it, but it worked out pretty well.
Sci-Fiction would have had legs the very year that it folded. I think it had something like between the Hugos and the Nebula, 5 nominations and at least 1 or 2 wins, but they were owned by NBC.
Yeah.
And NBC, they think in very, very large terms. And a website dedicated to science fiction, no matter how good, just wasn't on their horizon at the time. So with a blink of an eye, it just folded at the height of its popularity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they missed some opportunities back then. I mean, it was 2005, 2004, while they were running it, they were still trying to figure out how to use the web properly. And, there wasn't a lot of respect for online fiction. Sci-Fiction was one of the few exceptions. But they never integrated the Sci-Fiction site with the Sci-Fi Channel website that, it was part of.
Yeah.
They sort of kept them as separate beasts. And I think that was a huge missed opportunity. So they'd look at the costs of running this website that put out fiction, and it didn't serve anything other than fiction and wasn't propping up their channel.
Yeah.
So ultimately that probably didn't help. Corporate types are not the best at deciding the fate of science fiction, particularly short fiction.
Yeah, and particularly corporate types who are not publishers. This was a TV empire, a media empire, I should say, and print media was not in their horizon, especially web. It's not even print, it's web media, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So I would dare say that you are one of the first to actually stake a claim and hold on to it successfully.
Perhaps. Yeah, I'm trying to think of other ones. I mean, Strange Horizons was around early on, but they're a different business model, a nonprofit model, whereas I'm actually trying to make a living doing this.
Yeah, and so, something that I understand is going to become more of a full-time thing fairly soon.
My last day of work at my day job is next Tuesday.
And you work in the education field, do you not?
Yes, I work in technology in higher ed and K-12, and I've been in that field since 1989, so I've had a good run. It's been an interesting time to work in that field, and it's time for me to exit.
Yeah, and time for... Yeah, your other followings to flourish. Mm-hmm. Clark's World has been growing all along and reaching out, I think, to new horizons. I'm so interested in what you've been doing with Asian science fiction, which the people I work with use some of the same resources, but not to the extent that you do.
Ah. Well, it's been a lot of fun working. We've been doing a lot of Chinese translation through a partnership with a company called Storycom in China. And they've been great partners, and we're looking to do even more things in the year ahead. We've actually got an anthology of the stories that were translated that'll be a bilingual edition in China, probably coming out sometime in the next few months. And, you know, a few other projects I'm not allowed to talk about quite yet, but it's all very exciting. And I think that's really what's going to help keep the short fiction market afloat and growing is, you know, these days, particularly as a web publication, just saying we're an American magazine kind of silly. I mean, we're on the web, it's international, and we should be embracing that.
Yeah.
So we have.
Well, there's always the hairy question. You and I were actually on a panel, I think it was ReaderCon before last, or else it was a Caplave, about translations in science fiction. How successful are they? How can they be done? What are the cultural differences? One of my favorite interviews that I've done in the last decade was with Ken Liu. Who talked about, well, how do you take the American concept of wiggling fingers, God, and bring that to a culture where the Zhao is, you know, I don't want to explain what the Zhao is because I'll just make it end up sounding like something George Lucas came up with. But of course, he was drawing from that kind of a source for the Force. And it's absolutely fascinating stuff. What issues have you been dealing with? Now this is every issue at this point, right?
Yes, we have a story and translation in every issue. And you know, I'm not the translator. I am terrible with foreign languages. So we have worked with several different translators, and you know, they tend to deal with some of the stickier issues of the translation. Every now and then, I might see something in there that I'm not sure comes across right, and I might ask for clarification on it. Mm-hmm. But it's you know. I've been told some of the worst pieces to translate are things that might use puns or you know, other, you know, contextual things. We had one story which was an alternate history this year, And, you know, there was concern from the translator that not knowing the history might be a problem. And, you know, just I'm not a big fan of footnotes in short fiction, so this is where it always comes up in the translations. Mm-hmm. but our readers really liked it, and there was some great feedback on it. And even though they didn't understand, it was still a, you know, the story was what was important. So sometimes we can overthink these things, and a good story is going to be a good story when told well.
Yeah. Now you mentioned that you're working under a model as a nonprofit, and your material is available for free on the web, at least initially. Mm-hmm. Obviously the non-print material, and then there is the podcast, which we'll discuss shortly. What is the business model?
Okay, well, we're a for-profit. The non-profit I was talking about earlier was Strange Horizons, but our model, it's basically what I've dubbed pay for convenience. If you want an ebook, we sell the ebook. If you want a print copy, we sell a print copy. If you prefer anthologies, we collect all the stories at the end of a year and we sell the anthology. We also take donations, and we're on Patreon, which has worked out rather nicely for us. And we have subscriptions on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. And so there, you know, we're the same places where a number of the more traditional print magazines went. And if you look at the way things have been going over the last decade, we're sort of converging. You know, the traditional print magazines are doing a lot more digital. And Clark's World is doing the online and doing the digital like they are, but now we're also doing some of the print as well. So I tend to look at it as my responsibility is to get the stories that we publish read by as many people as possible. So we go where the audience is, audio, print, wherever.
Yeah. And so let's discuss the audio. Now, again, by way of full disclosure, I am the audio editor and host. I'm the audio editor of both Lightspeed Magazine and Nightmare Magazine. And I am the host. I am the host. It really sounds like you've got an old Epson printer there or something.
Well, it's not on my end.
It's not?
No.
Okay, maybe I'll take off my... You know, I'm hearing it in the headphones, but I am not... It's not ambient noise. It's not...
I thought it was somebody over there having some fun with you.
No. It's coming through the computer, I guess. Huh. And now, you see there, I turned down my mic for a second, and it continued. So let me turn down your mic for a second. Uh-huh. It's coming from your end. Or it's coming through Skype, anyway. It's coming through the computer and or Skype. Ooh. So, you know what? Let me close down some things on this idiot computer. Windows 10, blah. anyway. And here's Firefox. Let's close three tabs. You know, because maybe there's a tab on a browser that is doing something. Who knows? Anyway. There. And good, I didn't cut you off, so you're still there. And the sound has gone away for the moment. So it must have been something on this computer, a gremlin, no doubt.
Comes with the territory.
Yeah. So anyhow, so I was just giving disclosure that I work on the podcast, and the people who do the podcast that I work with are Skyboat Media, which are a professional audiobook company and producer and stuff who like to specialize in science fiction almost on a hobbyist basis, because that's not the big money. You know, they do a lot of major audiobooks, a lot. And and then you have one incredibly talented, fabulous host, Kate Baker, who is the sole voice of the podcast, host and narrator. And she chats. To me, listening to Kate, listening to the Clark's World podcast is like, I don't know, what would I compare it to? Some of my favorite late night FM radio, where you felt like you were really close to the announcer on air, spinning, you know, classic rock or something like that. And Kate has that same kind of a dynamic, whereas I am an announcer and I am saying hello and welcome to. So I'm sort of like the AM radio kind of thing. And then presenting these very professional, not that Kate isn't professional, but I mean, people, audiobook narrators, sometimes major actors, who are doing them. And Kate is just this phenomenon. They're very big. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Kate was probably one of the best hires I've ever done in any field. Mm-hmm. she's just fantastic and has made the podcast her own. I mean, she quite often says, "She let me tell you a story," or she's. And that's it. It's like someone that you know sitting down and telling you a story. She's been perfect for the role, and I hope she stays with us for as long as we're doing it.
Yeah. So do I. She's phenomenal, and they're two very different vibes, and they both work perfectly well. Mm-hmm. We'll just leave it at that. In New York, we have both the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series and the New York Review of Science Fiction Reading Series. And you know what? Nobody is losing audience to the other.
I think there's a lot of that in the short fiction world too. I think it's gotten a little crowded. There's a lot of publications out now, but it's always been fairly collegial. No one looks at the other as competition. They look at them as colleagues.
Yeah, that's fair, and that's a very good thing. Could you describe? Is there such a thing as a mission goal for Clark's World other than it's Neil Clark's World?
You mean what drives what stories we take?
What kind of a statement would you make? How would you describe the magazine to let's say
a
New York
moving target? I kind of have a great deal of difficulty coming up with that, and I've tried to over the years figure out just what it is that makes a Clark's World story. And I've had people tell me their theories, and I always hear them and I think, okay, well, you might have just been reading that one year or whatever, because I do feel like it's constantly moving. I get bored easy, so I don't like ruts. One of the reasons I got into technology was it was never the same thing twice. I like variety. I like finding stuff that's different than what I've already read. And that's sort of the driving force, is just to keep moving forward and discovering new things and new voices and new perspectives and ideas.
I think that's great, because I think what that ends up doing with that kind of a moving target kind of thing is it makes sure that the literature of speculative fiction or science fiction, fantasy, whatever the bleep we want to call it, that it evolves.
And that's not a criticism against what came before. I mean, I have been reading science fiction since I was 12, so 38 years. And, you know, I still remember fondly stuff I read when I was younger, and I'm sure it doesn't hold up if I read it now. But, it was the right story for the time for me, and I know that somebody else reading it today might get just as much enjoyment out of it. But, you know, I think there is definite, the field has definite drift to it. Like, we can all say, well, that's a 50s style story. I think it's a little harder to say that when you're closer to the time period. So to say what is a perfect, you know, 2000s story might be a little too soon.
I think topically you're correct. But, you know, when I think of, say, 50s style, I think of the birth of the Digest magazines like Galaxy and Analog Come Astounding, or other way around, Astounding Come Analog, and all that. And there was a certain kind of a story, the stories that ended with a punchline that, you know, that sort of, they grew out of that in the 60s as the new wave began in, say, 66 onward. And then 70s started to be a little more socially significant, perhaps. But the form of the fiction itself, I think I will read certain stories today and say, well, you know, that really has the vibe of, I won't say 50s, I'll say of an old Digest magazine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's clearly work out there. And I've read submissions and I've gone, wow, this has got a real retro feel to it. And when I say retro, I tend to be thinking 50s, maybe early 60s, for that. So, but it's very rare that I read something and go, oh yeah, that's got an early 2000s feel to it, you know?
Right. Some cyberpunk maybe.
Oh, that would be 80s for me.
Yeah, I guess. Yes, absolutely. Mirror Shades fiction. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Bruce Sterling era, I guess we might call that. So, in your branching out into anthologies, first of all, the two collections, the Updraft, I'm sorry, confusing you with Fran Wilde, who I haven't had on the air yet, damn it.
Who's also upgraded. Worked in technology.
I knew it was up mine or something like upgraded.
Yes.
And then Galactic Empires, which is just out now. We have really wonderful anthologies of really, let's just throw out some of the names in the table of contents here. Anne Leckley, Brandon Sanderson, Elliot de Baudard, Neil Asher. These are, I'm naming authors who I know and like. Paul Berger, Yunha Lee, Toby Buchel, Tobias S. Buchel, Robert Silverberg. There's a time-honored name. Chris Rush, Ken Scholes, Melinda Snodgrass, Naomi Novik. It's a good, good variety. How difficult question. How do you start by choosing your theme and then asking for looking around for properties that fit that theme?
In this case, there was some bouncing around with the publisher, because I had done the first volume of The Year's Best, and they were curious if I'd be interested in doing another project. So we started batting about some ideas for themes, and this one was the one that sort of stood out as, yeah, okay, this one really works cohesively. It's timely. There's, you know, I've read a lot of good stories over the last, 15, 20 years that fit this theme. And so, we thought, okay, this should work well. We did the same. The next one actually with them is after the year's best is More Human Than Human, which is an android synth replicants artificial humans type thing, and kind of amused me that Westworld came out and did as well as it did, because we already had this planned. Mm-hmm. And these things sort of work out sometimes, and picking the stories, I'll have a few authors that I identify as who I think sort of are the leading authors writing that type of story. Although he's not in Galactic Empires, I think somebody who defines the modern Galactic Empire is Ian Banks.
Yes, that's one of the first names that comes to my mind.
Yeah. He didn't write much in the way of the shorter fiction, and there was the first culture story I considered, but it was just outside of my time range for the project, I wanted to try and stick true to my original principle on that.
Yeah, and the culture series, we should just explain to listeners, is this, galactic-spanning series of worlds where the culture is one cultural and political outgrowth. My favorite, by the way, is The Player of Games. What is your favorite?
Oh God, it's really hard for me to pin it down, because they're all tied together, and I think they're all very strong. There's a couple that are not as strong as the others, but yeah. For the most part, that he did such an amazing job with that universe that he shaped what came after him, and a lot of these stories, as I was selecting pieces, I could see his influence in different ways.
Yeah,
it might be subtle, it might be overt, but the fingerprints are there, and I think I even sort of pointed him out in the introduction, saying something to that effect. But yeah, so it's a big book. It's 250,000 words, so it was sort of meant to be a broad scope view of the Galactic Empires, and it took some doing to find pieces that covered that wide array.
And you're using mostly modern authors. You weren't reaching back to Clifford D. Simak or Heinlein.
I stuck mostly to stories that were published in 2000 and later.
Yeah.
I think there might be a couple that are just before that, but I'm really trying to keep these in a 20-year window.
Yeah, and so pretty much stories from this millennium for the most part, strange as it is to think of it in those terms. But
mm-hmm.
When your topic is Galactic Empires, why not? let's see, these are all reprints, and we should mention to people, Ian Banks sadly is no longer writing. We lost him, and all too young, and he was two great writers. He was Ian Banks as a science fiction writer, and Ian M. Banks as a, dare we use the word mainstream, as his other fiction writer. And Ian, by the way, is, I think it's I-A-I-N, is that correct?
Yes.
Good. Okay. So this is a lovely trade paperback edition for Nightshade Books, and everybody should look for it. Treat yourself. It's what I always tell people, and this is going to segue into the best of books. The most frequently asked question through the God how many years of this radio show? Well, we began in 1972, actually, with Margot Adler, so the rest of you can do the math. The most frequently asked question is, how do you find writers that you like? How do you know when you don't know the genre? And the answer to that, that I've always given, is find anthologies, particularly anthologies who themed that the idea compels you, and then read those short stories, or a best of the year anthology, and just find the names of the writers that appeal to you and start reading the novels by those same writers. So the best of the year, now that's become quite an industry, hasn't it?
There are a number of them now, but the market seems to be sustaining them, and if it doesn't, some will go away. I was originally contracted for the first two volumes, and after the first one came out, we extended it to four. So I'm going to be doing this for at least a few more years.
And what kind of an effort does that require? Because it supposes, this is something that I've asked other people of who had similar tasks, of course, David Hartwell and Ellen Datlow and Gardner Dozois and all these people. I even got to ask Terry Carr, going back that far. I never got to ask Judith Merrill, who I think is probably helped start off the best of the year concept of anthologies. What is the process for you?
This type of project, it's reading all year. I think I described it to someone as drinking from the fire hose, because I have to read everything that comes out in a year. And if you take a month off, you're doomed. So you have to be reading throughout the whole year. And that's, you know, so I have a lot of magazines that are sent to me, new anthologies. And fortunately, I'm doing just best science fiction. So I, you know, if there's fantasy stories in there, I'll skip over them. And that cuts down on some of the pressure. And it allows the book to be a little more focused, because I tend to prefer ones that are a little bit more focused, like a science fiction volume or a fantasy volume. That way I can read what I'm feeling like at the time, rather than having to pick and choose through a book.
Has your publisher come up with a fantasy best of the year?
No.
I know there's one publisher that puts out a science fiction, a fantasy, and a horror.
Yes. And Hartwell used to have a fantasy and a science fiction one.
Yeah.
No, they have a horror one that's done by Ellen. And my best science fiction. From what I can tell over the years, it looks like in short fiction, science fiction does better. In novels, fantasy does better. I'm not too sure if that's just my crazy view of things, but it seems to pan out that way, particularly when we publish something that's got both in it in the magazine. The science fiction generally gets more attention. And that's just, you know, that's one of the nice things about, you know, publishing an online magazine. I get all sorts of statistics on who's reading what, and so I can see, you know, what types of stories are actually resonating better.
That's very interesting. So how does it break down, more or less?
Well, I can never, ever predict which one's going to take off. I might really love a story in an issue, and then I watch, and everybody drifts to the other story. that I thought was good. You know, it's obviously I thought it was good because I bought it to have in the magazine, but you know, it's sometimes I'm very surprised with the one that I thought was going to sail under the radar. So it's never easy to predict, but it's always interesting for me. I like numbers, so I play around with all sorts of statistics on where stories are being read from. And you know, I found an odd little statistic for our podcast that a very unusual country was in the top 10, and that was Iran.
Wow.
Yeah, it could have knocked me over with that one. I actually went back and double checked the data twice because I thought that was, you know, contrary to everything I'd ever been led to believe. And it turns out we've got an audience there, and that's great.
Yeah, well, I think the answer to that is you're not being read by the government, you're being read by the people.
Right. And you know, that, but it's so easy to lose touch with that these days. You know, all the talking heads on the televisions and radio and
stopped paying.
So-and-so did this and so-and-so did that. And they're one person out of tens of thousands or millions. And,
I have very actively stopped paying attention to news because I live in an alternate universe where November 8th never happened. Yeah, it's just, you know, I cannot deal with this. Science fiction, there's fantasy, and there's horror. And this goes in the third category. I have on my browser, I use Chrome, and I have two Chrome extensions. One takes the name of the alleged president and changes it to Voldemort or He Who Must Not Be Named or anything, so I don't ever have to see that person's name. And I have another extension that takes any photograph of that person and turns it into kittens. It's called Make America Kittens Again. And so this enables me. I just posted on Facebook, in fact. I shop online. I shop for food online, and I was looking up trumpet mushrooms. And instead of showing me the mushrooms, it had a picture of kittens. So as I say, I live in this fantasy universe, this alternate reality. So I'm not paying attention to those stats anymore. Just like I did during the Bush years and the Nixon years and all that. I am an ostrich. I don't know. I don't know if I want to ask the question of, do you see a trend in the genre changing? I guess I am asking the question as a result of modern politics, because the entire world, not just the U.S., is moving alt-right. Most of Europe.
You know, I tend to get annoyed when a story tries to be political. I don't care which way it goes. If it's trying to throw something at me and it's losing the story for the sake of the message, then it tends to get tossed.
Yeah.
So, you know, I like reading science fiction for an escape.
Yeah.
So keep dragging me back into the political world and that ends the story for me.
But then you have things that do it very well, like The Dispossessed.
Oh, yes. It can be done well, but most of it is not. Now, keep in mind, we get about 1,200 stories a month submitted to us.
Whoa!
And, yeah, and there's a we take maybe 5 to 10 of those.
Wow.
Or 4 to 10 of those, depending if it's a there have been months where it's even dropped lower than that. But you know, we'll end up with, you know, there's a certain percentage of that. Every now and then we get listed on a right for money site, and suddenly we just get deluged with stories by people who've never written science fiction before. And I love that they're trying, but, you know, a lot of them are clearly that they've never read science fiction before either. Mm-hmm. And they're sort of rehashing a TV show or something, or a role-playing game, or
well, that's so often.
So yeah,
I mean, I hate when I read the press in general. There was a time, of course, when you simply said science fiction or fantasy, and the media at large automatically ghettoized the literature, and it was synonymous with garbage. And then later on, I think what has happened is you see articles in the press and they refer to science fiction and they go, oh yeah, right. Star Trek, Star Wars, and, or Westworld. Now all they can, or Game of Thrones, if it's fantasy, all they can relate to, they know Tolkien because they've seen the movies.
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing. If there's any press coverage of a science fiction convention, they immediately go for the people in costume, even if it's a literary convention and they're the only person in costume. It's kind of sad that we've been pigeonholed by those mediums. But at the same time, we've come a long way. I mean, when I was a kid, I couldn't really like. I couldn't be seen in school reading a science fiction book,
right?
Or a fantasy book. I mean, that you would just get mocked and ridiculed.
I was flunked. Yeah. I was flunked for writing a book report of the Martian Chronicles,
mm-hmm.
because on the report was not read. It was simply on the grounds that it was science fiction.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. I the university I graduated from. No science fiction, that wasn't taken very seriously. And, today, these days, not all that long ago, they had someone teaching a class on Chinese science fiction, so in the English department, which yeah. I thought, okay, well, the times have definitely changed.
Yeah.
So I tell my kids, my oldest is 16 and youngest is 13, that they're very fortunate to live in a time where being a geek or a science fiction fan is actually socially acceptable, and not something that's going to get them bullied or mocked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is absolutely ghettoized. There was an era. My partner, who went to one of the SUNY colleges. I might as well name it because it's going to be clear in a moment, was SUNY Binghamton. And there was a professor there who belittled anything and everything science fiction and just discarded it as tripe. Never mind that another one of the creative writing teachers there was a woman named Joanna Russ. This mm-hmm. is when we're talking about the early 70s. And the college, in eventually, I won't say that they made a choice between the two, but suffice it to say that they eventually, when it came down to whether giving Joanna tenure or not, they let her go rather than have continual teaching of science fiction by one of the finer teachers of the arts.
Mm-hmm.
So. And when this show began on WBAI, 5 to 7 a.m., science fiction was a ghetto. There were no two ways about it. Now,
there's cracks forming.
We're
getting some begrudging respect from the literary community, and it's kind of nice to see. I was at an event in Houston last year, the first time it was Write Fest, and I was There was a lot of literary journals, and me, I was one of the keynote speakers. And, you know, I was right alongside people who were doing McSweeney's and, mm-hmm. you know, having conversations with them. And some of the people that were in attendance, one of them came up to me and was taking a look at the magazine I had on the table. And 2 minutes later, she's like, I guess I have to buy this. I can't put this story down. And she's like, I don't read science fiction. I said, you do now.
And yet McSweeney's publishes their share.
Oh, yes, yes. And, you know, you're starting to see more of that stuff over on their side. So there are cracks in there. You get people like Philip K. Dick getting a real, from like literary collections, I guess.
Library of
blanking
America.
Blanking on with Library, yes. Was it New American Library?
Of America.
Library of America.
And one will point out, the guest editor was Jonathan Lethem.
Yes. So I had other people coming up to me, have you ever heard of this guy? I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's one of the authors that shaped my opinions as a kid.
It's a shame, and even then they get it wrong, because there are how many Philip K. Dick adaptations out there? And,
oh, God, those are awful.
They really are. There are a couple of good ones. There are a few movies I can name that are actually quite good. Topping my list is A Scanner Darkly, directed by Richard Linklater.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very good but very unknown adaptation of Radio Free Albemuth. For some reason, I don't know why, the TV series of The Man in the High Castle does not totally suck.
Oh, yeah. No, that's been surprising me. I was fully prepared to hate that show.
Oh, so was I, especially because I did not care for the translation of Philip K. Dick into Blade Runner.
Oh, really? See, I was more accepting of that.
Yeah,
I am horrified by the thought of a sequel, but
I have to say, I saw the trailer for the sequel, and I have to say, it looks interesting. It really does. I think, you know, it's taking the idea of the movie, it's totally, but you know, Blade Runner, the movie, totally cast aside the novel. It has very little to do with
Phil's blessing, though.
He didn't know much about it. And I have the interview that was done with Mike Hodel, who was sort of my counterpart in L.A. at KPFK, to prove it. He knew very little about the movie until he actually wandered through the set being with Sean Young on his arm. So he was besotted. And and unfortunately, he died before the film ever came out.
Yeah.
So, of course, you offer somebody like that money for his science fiction. He had only really seen real money for his mainstream fiction, which he didn't care for that, but you know, he wrote for the market.
Well, he never even he had a lot of those were unpublished, those mainstream novels, and that I think was one of those things that was a disappointment to him.
Yeah.
A case where it's a real shame that he didn't live to see the success of his work, that it would have such a lasting impact.
Yeah, but on the other hand, as we said, the quality of most of those movies really suck.
Oh, yeah.
And Blade Runner, is an extremely brilliant, visionary film that in which the very premise that Dick had of an underpopulated L.A., underpopulated, which was about a toy maker who was and a replicant hunter, who are having personal and religious significant changes. And it's largely, the book is largely about religion. If you remember that you go to any street corner and put your hands in a device and bond with this messy, with this martyr-like character, that's much of what the book is about.
Mm-hmm.
None of that is even approached in the movie.
The one that really offends me is Total Recall.
Oh, please.
that has nothing to do with the story aside from the recall.
Yeah, there is in the first version about a 3-minute sequence where Arnie is waking up and isn't quite sure whether he's actually on Mars or on Earth wearing a headset, and he doesn't know what the reality is. And for 3 minutes of the 2-hour running time, it almost has some Philip K. Dick content. The rest of it, not. But there have been, Man in the High Castle is interesting because what they did was they took the premise beautifully and faithfully, and then they wrote their own story, which isn't Dick's story, but the universe in which they set it is very, very true to Phil Dick.
Yeah, it's almost an alternate Dick story.
which is so appropriate given that's one of the best alternate history novels ever writ.
Yes.
Getting back to... Okay, first, would you like to try to take listener calls?
Sure.
Okay, listeners, we're going to try this. The telephone number to speak on the air to Neil Clark or myself, Jim Freund, but you need to be on topic, as Neil is the guest, is area code 347-335-0818. Again, 347-335-0818. And, if I knew more of what I was doing with the Skype technology, I could offer people to Skype in, and maybe sometime in the future I'll try that. But we do have a call coming in, so let me see.
Oh, we're not the only ones that are up this late.
No. Well, believe it or not, one of the lovely things about the modern age is we have people listening all over the world.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
After today, James, you probably won't hear from me for a while because I'm headed for North Dakota.
Okay.
Trump is doing his best to pollute. Anyway.
I've never heard of him.
Yeah. I apologize. He who shall not be named. Good morning, Mr. Clark.
I would like to
ask you about Galactic Empires. I like the title right then and there. Let me ask you about the premise. Are all the stories set in a situation where all of the polities are imperiums, whether terrestrial or otherwise?
That's a good question.
I tried to cast a wide net, so you've got. I'm going to ask you to give me what you would consider an imperium first, because I've had several people give me different takes on
that. Well, an imperium to me would be a system where at the top is an emperor or some ruler, perhaps in a hereditary situation. You might say it might be a figurehead. There are different imperiums. There's obviously the Japanese system where, for all intents and purposes, the emperor was a figurehead. I mean, he was the emperor. He was divinity, but he was a figurehead. And then there were absolute systems, as in post-Republican Rome.
Mm-hmm. Some of these stories take place, in the wreckage of the empire. So there's no real control going on, but there's sort of influencing things, whereas others do actually fit that model very tightly, where there's one story where there's very clearly an emperor, but the issue of distance causes communication to be a problem. And, you know, that's, when I was picking through the stories, I wanted to make sure there were a variety of different types of systems, because I think it would get boring to read the same thing. In this story, the emperor does this. In this story, the emperor does that. So I wanted to make sure that it, you know, sometimes the emperor, there's an emperor, sometimes there might be one, but he's irrelevant to the story. And it's more about living in the empire and...
any of these stories, and I hate to say this because this to me is, I mean, there's many systems, as I've said, are any of the stories kind of pseudo Star Wars Imperium? Or would somebody say, oh, this sounds just like, you know, what was the emperor's name again? I forget.
Palpatine.
Palpatine. Are there any Palpatine type stories in your collection?
Nothing that I would describe as that.
That's good.
No, I think it's fair to say, with the quality of the writers and the stories in here, the quality of the writers, and pardon me, Neil, the editor, that's a bullet that has been ducked.
That's good. I'm very glad.
Original thinking. I mean, when you deal with huge, vast concepts, or better yet, constructs. Anne Leckie is just amazing with her originality and all that. You cannot compare a lot of these ideas to anything that you have seen in media and probably read, for that matter.
May I ask you specifically, what is the Naomi Novik? I love her work.
Hold on a second, I will tell
you while you're looking.
It's called Seven Years from Rome.
I wanted to make sure I got the title right.
Not Rome.
Seven Years from Home.
I must tell you, as I love the Temeraire series because of its historical nature, I thought her book Uprooted is absolutely fantastic.
I love that. Yes.
I mean, that first of all, it's the only book that I know that's set in a quasi Polish imperial system. I mean, to me and her research, I'd love to talk to her sometime about her historical and cultural research, because she is so dead on in so many things on that. Anyway, so this is what was her story again? 7 years from
7 years from home.
Well, I am looking forward to this. One last question. What was the first collection you did? Because I missed the title. Upgraded?
Upgraded. That was a collection of original cyborg stories, which sort of came from... the short version of the story is that almost 5 years ago, I had a heart attack at a science fiction convention.
I was there.
And it almost killed me. I ended up with a defibrillator. And while I was recovering from surgery, people were joking that I was now a cyborg. And we thought it'd be funny if a cyborg did a cyborg anthology.
I was there. It was a horrifying thing. My partner and I always go to ReaderCon, which is, I'll say it outright, my favorite convention. And we always go early. So we see the hucksters, that is to say, people that have book tables at ReaderCon. It's only book tables. Loading in, and Neil had just arrived and was loading in these, you know, hotel carts worth of things, and we saw him go in and go out, and he didn't quite make it back. A minute later, very briefly later, thank God, there were ambulances. ReaderCon has a they have some medical people on hand because they do a blood drive.
Ooh.
and they knew who to call. Is this right, Neil?
Well, actually, the front desk knew who to call.
The hotel.
Their Leahy Clinic was before they changed hotels a block away or a couple blocks away. A 1 minute drive. So that was one of the big things that saved me was getting over there. And it's an amazing hospital, and I'll always be grateful for that.
It was the kind of a heart attack that they call a widowmaker.
Did you get the defibrillator eventually or not?
Oh, yes, I did.
Then I should talk to you.
6 months after the heart attack.
Because I should talk to you sometime because my cardiologist is making lots of loud noises that I should get one, and I'm having second, third, and fourth thoughts, but that's another story. Listen, I want to wish you great luck. Where can one get the Galactic Empires? I've got to read
and
it.
And any bookstore near you.
Yep.
Really?
Barnes & Noble has it. Amazon has it.
It's a major book.
Oh, it is.
Powell's, wherever you buy your books, you should be able to get it from them.
600 pages.
And by the way, if you want to talk to me about the defibrillator, my email address is on my website. I'd be more than happy to share.
What is your website, please?
Neil-Clark.com.
Spell that,
please. And it's N-E-I-L-C-L-A-R-K-E.
Neil-Clark, did you say?
Yes, yes. So there's another Neil Clark out there that owns the other domain.
Yeah, or if you want to be sure of getting the right one, Clark's World.
Yes,
Clark's
World Magazine. And if you look at the staff page, it'll list my website there.
All right, I may contact you. By the way, will you be at ReaderCon this year?
I try to be there every year. It's my favorite convention as well.
Yeah.
I'll buy you lunch or dinner. I get there.
Okay.
Anyway, James,
thanks for calling. Take care. We have, believe it or not, we have like 5 minutes left.
Wow, that went fast.
Oh, yes, it does. It really does. And, I can make an announcement regarding how fast the show goes. I don't know if it's in a week or 2 weeks, but soon, the show will be expanded. Once again, restored, I should say, not expanded, restored to 2 hours. We will be beginning instead of 1:30. We will be beginning at 1 a.m. and going to 3 a.m. This is not a big program change. What's happening is that there are a few shows being shifted about. My understanding was that this would be effective next week, but I heard Catherine Davis signing off just beforehand saying that she will be here next week. So she would normally go to 1:30. But this is coming up soon. It's been announced. It's official. The program manager let me put it on Facebook and everything. So since we have so little time left, I just use some of it to say that. But What other projects, Neil, can you talk about? We haven't mentioned that Neil's also the editor of The Bulletin, which is the magazine for members of the Science Fiction Writers of America, and is would you call that a trade publication, Neil?
I suppose so. It is available for purchase by non-members. They can order it through the CIFWA website or digital copies through Waitlist Books.
Its
real focus is on science fiction and fantasy writers, members of the organization. So there might be some stuff that's specifically relevant to members, but I try to keep the focus towards things that would be useful to writers in general.
And writers who have not yet published, I dare say, would find a lot of useful things in there. Just a way of understanding how to get your feet wet. And there's a lot that CIFWA has to offer in cautioning people about what not to do.
Mm-hmm.
And what pitfalls may lie. And the Bulletin does a very good job with that. So with a minute left, Neil, why don't you tell people again your websites, your books, how to read you and reach you and listen to your product?
Okay. Well, all things related to Clark's World are at clarksworldmagazine.com. There's subscription information, information on the podcast, and the stories themselves are all there, fiction and nonfiction. Galactic Empires is out in stores now from Nightshade Books. Best Science Fiction of the Year Volume 2 will be out in April. And my website is neil-clark, that's neil-clark.com. And the magazine is clarksworldmagazine.com.
And you can get the podcast from either iTunes, or I use something that I like a lot called Podcatcher.
There's also Stitcher.
There's Stitcher, which is very good. So, in other words, anything that gathers podcasts well is a good way. And you, whoops, hold on. And you just search for Clark's World. Clarkeswold. So, music's in the background. I guess we're done. We haven't done this often enough, but that's also because I haven't been allowing. I hate phone calls. Skype is a little bit better. Do I still have you, Neil?
Yes, I'm still here.
Oh, okay. So, thank you for being here. Let's do this again, and let's talk off the air about doing a Clark's World event at the reading series.
Sure thing. Thank you for having me.
Okay, thanks so much. Have a good morning.
You too.
Take care. Night-night.
Night.
And this has been Hour of... Oh, I love that little Skype sigh. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. I will be on next week again at either 1 or 1:30 a.m. Until 3, stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way in just a few minutes. And this is my current sign-off, and it's going to stay that for a minimum of 4 years. Please, everybody, be good to each other. These are tough times, and we need to focus on treating each other like human beings, good human beings. Thank you very much. You can find me at ourwolf.com, a website in dreadful need of rehab, and Facebook. There's an Hour of the Wolf group and a New York Review of Science Fiction group, and a Jim Freund me. Anyway, good morning, take care, and be healthy.
Myself torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression. shit. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. And drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the figs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Single is still alive, WBA.
Don't do that.
10 minutes after fat burning time, WBAI. Clap pass. On the radio, still pussy marching. Still pussy marching. Yes, I am. List alive until 5. Your weekend begins right now. 99 Sinker List Alive. Pennsylvania, this is for you.